Hey, how are you doing? I stopped doing podcasts because I came to the conclusion that not only does reason have a very small part to play in the world, as David Hume would say, but that it's got a much, much smaller part to play in the world than even I had thought. However, we're now in Saturday, and we've had a week of headlines, all following on from obviously the Chancellor's remarkable non-budget as his fiscal event, I think, as Liz Truss described it. So I've decided that however little effect reason has in the world, it'll do me good to get it off my chest, get my two cents off my chest, if that's not mixing my metaphors too far. But it'll do me good to have my say, even if it doesn't change anything. So I thought I would use Yanis Varoufakis's article in The Guardian today as a springboard to have a general pop at a lot of the things that are being said. The Varoufakis piece in The Guardian is standard Yanis Varoufakis. He's the former Greek finance minister. When I used to teach, one of the students said something funny when I showed a picture of Yanis Varoufakis, and this lad said, "He looks like a murderer." And you kind of knew what he meant, you know. He did that kind of slightly sinister look about. But Varoufakis was the Greek finance minister during the Greek crisis, or part of it, and he also advised the UK to walk away from negotiations with the EU because he said it was completely impossible to deal with them. I read Varoufakis's book based on an old saying from the Greek classical world, the title based on a saying from the Greek classical world: the weak suffer what they must, the strong do as they will, the weak suffer what they must. And Varoufakis wrote a book after the Greek financial crisis, which I read and had a long comment on in the Financial Times website on the review of the book. I posted a long comment because I didn't understand what he was saying, and I thought that he didn't understand what he was saying. And I invited those who championed his ideas to tell me why the failure was mine, and that in actual fact he was a model of clarity and knew what he was saying, and it was me that was mistaken. It didn't happen. So Varoufakis has been a darling of the left for a long time. He's a professor of economics, and he's had a platform both before the Greek crisis, because that's why he became the finance minister, and since. Because the world has obviously been plunged into a difficult period following on from first the housing crash and then everything that followed, the Greek crisis, the debt crisis, being part of the broad panoply of economic failure across large parts of the developed world. So the article in The Guardian, as I say, has a pop, a sustained attack on Truss's budget. And it's like the old curate's egg, good in parts, because he's right about some things and he's wrong about others. He sees Truss as being just the latest iteration of a broader tendency since the 1980s, or specifically since 1979, a broad approach to economics, which he describes as trickle-down theory. Now, trickle-down is basically a left-wing characterization of what the right, at their most coherent, believe in. So that there's a it's like neoclassical or neoliberal, and these are expressions that are just thrown about by critics of everything that could be painted as right-wing. And anything that doesn't involve raising taxes and spending more borrowed public money to the satisfaction of public sector workers, the users of public services and welfare recipients. Anything that doesn't involve that is unspeakably right wing for a fair group of folk, including not just politicians on the left, but also people in the media and obviously the representatives of the recipients of the money, the trade unionists most obviously, and also the pressure groups. So Truss is seen by Varoufakis as being the latest representative of this right-wing tendency, which people like him, who are on the side of the angels, rightly deprecate. the budget did do some remarkable things, or not the budget, the fiscal event. I think if she'd been a fan of Mitchell and Webb, the comedians should have chosen another word rather than event, because of course they have a mock game show, The Event, which is essentially what happens after a nuclear winter, and the BBC broadcast on the emergency channel, and we have game shows to decide who will win the high energy biscuits that week. So she called it a fiscal event, and not a budget, because a budget would have all kinds of implications in terms of scrutiny beforehand, Treasury involvement, OBR assessments and so on. So it was a fiscal event. Just thinking on my feet, actually, it's a fiscal event in the same way that the Russian invasion of Ukraine is a special military operation. You want to avoid the word war. I think in the 1960s, the Americans described the Vietnam War as a policing operation. Not too many policing operations have air support and artillery, but I think that was what they said. So the budget did do some remarkable things, including giving 50,000 in tax cuts, income tax cuts to people earning a million. One of the very frustrating things about Britain is the slackness in speech and in writing. Ed Miliband was only one of a number of people who said that millionaires would get £50,000. Owen Jones, a few years ago, the Guardian journalist, the young left-wing agitator, was taken to pieces by Andrew Neil because he said that this tax cut would give a tax cut at that point would give a certain amount of money to everybody in the Tory cabinet who was a millionaire. And as Andrew Neil pointed out, the fact that someone is a millionaire doesn't mean they have £1 million worth of income every year. It means they have £1 million in savings or investments or assets. Two very, very different things. A poverty-stricken pensioner in London with a house that she bought in the 70s is a millionaire because the house will sell for £1 million. But she might be living on her pension and have absolutely no money. She has far more wealth than most Premier footballers because they've got big mortgages and they're spending every penny they get. So there's a distinction between wealth and income, which a lot of people on the left seem not to understand. But then again, there's much that they don't understand because they don't make any effort. So if you were earning a million, you could be up 40 or 50 grand. The figures vary slightly depending who you listen to, but somewhere in that ballpark. And Varoufakis suggests that the only imaginable purpose of that for those who aren't millionaires is the ludicrous one of trying to encourage them to become millionaires. He says that the Deliveroo rider presumably will be encouraged to push the pedals a bit harder and be a bit more ambitious. I used to work with somebody who was thought to be very sort of very progressive and very pleasant, but she felt safe to actually reveal her true nature when she was talking only to me. And I was quite shocked when she said some of the lowly paid members of staff were talking about going on strike, and she said maybe they should have worked a wee bit harder at school. I remember thinking, not even I am quite that judgmental. But Varoufakis says that the tax cut, from a trickle-down economics point of view, is presumably intended to inspire the lowly paid to become more highly paid. And he suggests that that's the gist of this supposed Tory growth strategy. It's painted by Truss and Kwarteng as being all about growth. It's a push for growth. The Tony Blair Institute, that I wouldn't normally reference, but they're probably not wrong when it comes to calculating basic economics. And they think that even if it delivers the growth that they would like, it'll have nothing like the implications in terms of tax receipts. So you're talking about giving away, I think they said five times what you could conceivably get in tax receipts, even if you raise the growth rate. So, but it's supposed to be all about growth. And this, says Varoufakis, is the zombie idea that will not die. It's been 4 decades of talk about trickle-down economics and growth and the benefits to the poor of liberating the rich. And reality, he claims, is, and obviously I'll pick apart why I think much that he says is wrong. The reality, he says, is that the people who receive these tax cuts won't do what would have been done 250, 300 years ago by the merchants and traders of the early commercial age. No No essay, no piece on economics is complete without a reference to Adam Smith and his inquiry into the causes and the nature of the wealth of nations. And Varoufakis obliges. He says that the butcher, the brewer, the baker, given a tax cut, might well have invested in a new tun to boil the wort. They might well have invested in a new insulated oven to retain the heat. But that isn't what happens when you give the rich today tax cuts. What they do is they invest in funds, which themselves invest in bonds and shares and derivatives. So they're not going to buy some piece of machinery. They're not going to buy a £3 million computer-controlled lathe from the United States and use it to cut precision steel in the UK and sell the product. That's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is they're going to stick it straight into a relatively low-cost fund investing in a whole load of assets, because the people who are going to get these tax cuts are savvy about how the world actually works. So they'll know exactly which Mayfair hedge fund is markets neutral, maybe, and they'll stick their tax cut into this. It'll be structured so it's a venture capital trust, so they'll get tax advantages, and it'll be relatively cheap because they'll be au fait with exactly all the ways that people involved in the markets can stiff you for money. For example, by soft commission, by giving trades to people who then help them. And so these savvy individuals won't be buying equipment and investing in direct investment in the UK. They'll be sticking it into funds, and therefore it'll do the broader economy no good whatsoever. So the tax cut won't result in anything other than a blowing up of share prices and real estate prices, probably the London property market. Now, Truss, as I say, is thought by Varoufakis to be the final, not the final, but the latest version of the representatives, starting with Margaret Thatcher, of this right-wing politics and economics. But even Thatcher thinks Varoufakis knew what Truss doesn't know. Thatcher knew that these tax cuts, and of course people forget that the famous 1981, a lot of people have been referencing Thatcher's or the Thatcher government's 1981 budget being condemned by the 364 economists in the Times and being championed by Patrick Minford alone, who of course Truss is also cited as being her supportive economist. But Minford was right in 1981 and the others were wrong. Growth very quickly came through. What people forget, however, when they say that, you know, Thatcher's budget was attacked and so is the Truss Kwarteng budget, what they forget is that in 1981, it was a tax-raising budget and it smashed inflation. It was doing the exact opposite of what Truss and Kwarteng are doing. They've got high inflation and they're throwing tax cuts into it, which will, ceteris paribus, other things being equal, cause more inflation. So the two budgets were unpopular, but that's where the similarity ends, because Thatcher was doing, it seems to me, at least the opposite of what Truss is doing. But Thatcher, says Varoufakis, knew what Truss doesn't know, which is that these tax cuts will achieve little, so therefore she did other things. And he cites the selling off of all the public assets, all the utilities. If you weren't alive in the 1980s, you won't remember all the advertisements for, I think it was Telfred, Telcid, it was Telcid. Tell Sid about it, the British gas sale is on. They're selling off British gas if you want to buy shares. So she sold off the assets, and he says that this produced enough economic growth to provide slim justification for her project. But she knew that the tax cuts in themselves would achieve little. And according to Varoufakis, for all the apparent differences in the Blair Brown years over Thatcher, in actual fact, it was much the same. It was deregulation. It was using the private sector where you would otherwise have used the state. It was a continuation of the same broad approach of satisfying a particular kind of economic interest to the expense of the general public. Now, in 2008, as we all remember, I think, if you listen to this podcast, you probably do remember 2008, although maybe only just. But in 2008, it all went wrong. As Varoufakis says, we ended up having socialism for the rich. because Gordon Brown and, of course, in the United States, the Obama administration, they bailed out all those who had made massive losses, or at the very least they extended and pretended. They flooded the markets with money such at very low interest rates, such that those who held bad assets could probably keep holding them until the price recovered, or they hoped it recovered. People who'd invested in bank debt, I'll moan shortly about my consternation, or I won't moan about my consternation, I'll express my consternation at this inability of folk to care about differences that matter. If you're an investor in a bank, not a saver, not somebody walking in the front door, if you're an investor in a bank, if you're the person who actually provides the fundamental capital of the bank, your shares, you own the shares in the bank, or you provide the so-called junior and senior debt, which I think contributes to the so-called tier one capital. If you do that, you're investing in a kind of bond. And that word alone protects you. That word saves you. That word allows you free money. Because the public can't care about the difference between the bond that they bought when they walked in or went online and invested the £20,000 and the so-called bond that the tier one or tier two investor in the City of London with billions to invest in. Because the public don't care about the differences between things which have got the same words, the rich people get to have the money of the poor. So all the people who invested in the tier one, tier two, junior and senior debt, who should have lost their money when the banks went bust, they all got bailed out. There was socialism for the rich. Then in 2010, says Varoufakis, we had the tin lid added with George Osborne and austerity and reductions in public spending, which of course, as he says, stripped aggregate demand out of the economy. Because when the government stops spending, and this is Stephanie Kelton, the modern monetary theorist's hobby horse as well. When the government stops spending and when it takes money out of people's pockets, demand for all goods and services falls as well. And therefore there's a straightforward formula that explains exactly what the implications will be for economic growth when you cut public spending. This also, says Varoufakis, means that there's no incentive to invest in the actual productive base. There's no incentive to open a car plant. I think a car plant is remarkably cheap. People think 500 million or a billion is a lot of money, but it's not really if you think about it. It doesn't take that many investors to get 500 million or a billion together. A battery plant in Wales that's costing, you know, a billion or more sounds like a lot of money, and it does generate a lot of jobs and a lot of economic activity, but it's a remarkably small sum of money for so many productive benefits. But, says Varoufakis, in a declining country with collapsing demand, you don't invest in that way. And therefore, in actual fact, you cut your own throat because you've won the election in the way that Osborne and Cameron did, by spinning a story of why the crash happened. This is what the left typically believe. I'm not subscribing to that. I'm just saying this is what people say. Cameron and Osborne convinced people that it was overspending that caused the financial crash, and therefore they continued with that narrative because they had little choice. And also as well, they were antipathetical to the public sector, hostile to the kind of the class of people and the kind of attitudes that animated local government and much of central government. So austerity took place after 2010, and the decline in aggregate demand below that which it would otherwise have been contributed to low tax receipts and an increase in debt and a continuation of the problems that had been caused by the 2008 crash. Paul Krugman is said to have won the Nobel Prize in economics. It's not quite the Nobel Prize, I think, but it's the same kind of thing. I don't think the Nobel Committee has a prize, but he's known as a Nobel Prize winning economist. It's not quite, as I say, a Nobel Prize, but it's something awfully akin to it. And he also is a darling of the left. And Varoufakis cites him in support. He praises in aid his theory that there's very little impact or no impact on growth from tax cuts. looking at the United States, there doesn't seem to be any effect whatsoever. And as to the effects in the UK of this right-wing deregulation of the economy and the liberation of animal spirits and this red in tooth and claw survival of the fittest market-led economy, the gap in productivity per hour, says Varoufakis, in 2019 between France, Germany and the UK is the same as it was in 1979. So even in its own terms, it hasn't worked. Truss's position is said to be worse than that of Thatcher and Reagan, because Reagan had the, as Varoufakis says, the mighty dollar. In other words, he was able to make use, as people on the left always say, they talk about the dollar being the world's reserve currency, and therefore American presidents can do what nobody else can do. They can spend and they can cut taxes and they can run up debt in a way that nobody else can, because the dollar is the world's reserve currency. And I'll talk in a minute about why that mystical claim means less than you'd think. But Varoufakis again says that, as people on his side of the spectrum always say, that the Americans are in a position that's privileged compared to everybody else. Truss is in a particularly difficult position because she can't do what Thatcher did, which was sell off state assets and thereby acquire funds that allow you to reduce taxes and to some extent maintain public spending without having to anger the public by raising taxes. There's nothing left to sell, and therefore Truss has done what a person on the neoliberal right, to a degree that hasn't been common in the Tory party for a long time. Truss and Kwarteng and a few others wrote a book, I think, back in 2011-2012, espousing the kind of theories that most of the Tory party probably don't believe in to that kind of degree. But she's put herself in a difficult position because the things that she said, just like Cameron and Osborne, but more so, the things she said to win that leadership, she then has to carry out. But she can't do what Thatcher did, which is flog off assets and use the resulting receipts to some extent flatter the public finances. So she's in a very difficult position. And it looks as if, says Varoufakis, Kwarteng is going to do what Osborne did and double down on bad ideas and have austerity on top. Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's former press secretary, was complaining the other day on Twitter that it looks as if the move to reassure the financial markets about the public finances is not going to be a reversal of the tax cuts, it's going to be reductions in public spending. So they're going to convince the financial markets that there's less to worry about, because they're going to say, we're going to spend less, we're going to cut public spending, and that will reduce aggregate demand. Varoufakis concludes by making the very bold claim, which is that tax cuts never, never generate growth. And that's a strong, strong claim. And also that austerity never reduces the growth of public debt. And again, a very, very strong claim. And similar actually to the Stephanie Kelton modern monetary theory position, which is that it's only by government spending money into existence that the private sector gets the funds it needs to make the economy liquid and allow all the exchanges to take place. The money supply is spent into existence by the public sector, and therefore typically governments spend too little and deficits are good. And Varoufakis concludes by saying that the Tories are definitely going to lose, and the only issue that remains to be settled is whether Starmer has got a plan to finally put a bullet in this and to stop the continuation of what has been the same basic story, albeit with different actors, since 1979. The Scottish former First Minister and Finance Secretary John Swinney, SNP politician, used the expression too wee, too poor, I think, and he added a third thing. I don't think it was too stupid, but he coined this expression to supposedly characterise the views of those opposed to Scottish independence, and it stuck. But it wasn't actually an expression ever used by anybody opposed to Scottish independence. This expression trickled down economics, It's got everything. It's got exactly the kind of offensive crumbs from a rich man's table quality that allows it to stick. But nobody in the centre right characterises their position as being trickle down economics. The idea that you let the rich keep all their money and you can employ the poor as objets d'art, standing in their gardens holding an umbrella with a bag of carrots in the other hand to the general amusement of the Bullingdon Club, that isn't actually anybody's view of how an economy works. Ali Kuan Yew, who talks about capitalism with Asian values in Singapore, doesn't believe in letting rich people simply escape all social obligations and you know, come to dominate the society in a kind of oligarchy. So this trickle-down economics is just an expression used by people on the left to castigate those who don't agree with them. It is true that not all tax cuts are equally good, but the best evidence for what somebody will do is what they've already done. And when Varoufakis continually talks about these tax cuts for people earning more than £150,000 as being tax cuts for bankers, that's two different things. Most of the people earning more than £150,000 won't be bankers. They'll be people who are IT experts in insurance, and there'll be people who are geophysicists in the oil industry on international contracts, maybe. There'll be people like that. The folk have got a very incomplete or utterly defective, in some cases, view of how the economy works and who gets paid a lot of money for what reason. So the entrepreneurs, the people who are running businesses, the people who are helping businesses to run well through having jobs like, for example, being a cost and management accountant in a successful £150 million business in the West Midlands, those people are doing the things they are doing because of the kind of people and the kind of motivations and the kind of worldview they've got. So if you want to get somebody to invest in a new, for example, a pal of mine at university who became a senior IT professional and whose wife is, in actual fact, funnily enough, the chairperson of a FTSE 100 company, his dad back in 1989 invested, I can't remember, it was somewhere like 250 grand, 400 grand, that kind of money, which in 1989 was a lot of money. He invested in a big drive-in oven to bake cars so that you could actually repair cars to the manufacturer's standard and therefore get insurance work. So if a car gets bashed, it has to be repaired properly. And that doesn't involve spraying it. It involves actually treating it the way it was treated in the factory. So he invested an absolute fortune in this massive oven, which meant that he could repair cars to, I think it was Ford standards, and make some money. Now, the person who's going to invest that kind of dough, and just as an aside, when he wound up the business, took a retirement job making things for another producer, and they were cutting MDF, medium density fibre board, without protection and ventilation, and he walked off the job because he thought it was a complete disgrace that any producer would have exposed workers to that kind of risk. So not everybody who's the classic, you know, middle-ranking entrepreneur has got the characteristics that some people would claim. So the best evidence for what you're going to do is what you've already done. If you want somebody who can pass four hires at grade A, the best evidence that they'll do that is they've got five national fives at grade A. People who tell you what they're going to do when they've never done anything similar before, it is extremely unlikely they're actually going to do it. People have got completely false ideas of what they themselves are capable of. It's called first-person exceptionalism. So the best evidence for what somebody's going to do is what they've already done. So when people talk about tax cuts for entrepreneurs and privileged people, these tax cuts, if they're structured well, are likely to produce positive outcomes, because the people who've already invested in a business, if you give them the opportunity, are quite likely to invest yet more in the business. That, however, doesn't excuse what Truss and Quartang did. which was an across-the-board tax cut, which, as Varoufakis and many others have rightly pointed out, is quite unlikely to end up in productive investment, especially because the way that they did it was so inept, it's going to cause them to lose the next election. And this is one of those classic sort of reflexive problems, one of these problems that were produced by the very act that you did. The thing that you did has actually made it worse. It's one of these odd social phenomena where it would have worked, but for the fact that you did it in the way that you did it. So what's happened is, because they're going to lose the next election, nobody will invest because they think that the Tories are going to lose the next election. So the implementation of the proposal or the plan was so inept, in actual fact, it has scuppered the plan. The plan might have worked if it had been done better. So the across-the-board tax cuts, funded essentially by debt, because of course public spending is not being cut to the degree necessary for these tax cuts to be anything other than essentially borrowing money to give it to relatively affluent people. That's what it amounts to. You're taxing people right now and you're using the receipts to pay for public services. You're going to reduce the taxation on those people and you're going to give them more of their own money to keep. That, in effect, is borrowing money to give to rich people. And the financial markets are not happy with it. So, as I say, the best evidence of what somebody will do is what they've done. And therefore, tax cuts for entrepreneurs are generally a good idea. Because what they did with their first tranche of money, they'll probably do if you give them more, if you give them the chance. Especially if it's, in a sense, cheap money, because they're not having to borrow it. You're simply allowing them to keep more of what they earn. So these tax cuts are generally a good idea. People who claim that all tax cuts are simply a giving away of possible public spending to people who don't need the money and it'll end up in imported cars and frivolous consumption, that's false. One of the reasons why there is a problem with tax cuts is precisely because there is a problem with democracy. We can never persist in any policy long enough to find out what the results will be. It's interesting that people like Varoufakis always talk about tax cuts, and they cite, for example, Krugman in America talking about the different tax regimes between governments. But that's because you never have a situation where it's stable for a long period of time. There's a difference between tax cuts and low taxes. It's only in a Singapore where you can actually persist with a relatively low taxation regime for long enough to see the benefit come through. Because if you've got volatility in tax regime, which you typically do get in democracies as we switch from one government to another, because we insist on having stupid electoral systems like first past the post, which cause violent changes in policy. If there was a stable, relatively low tax regime, you begin to see the benefit of letting people who've done clever things in the past have more latitude to do future clever things. But we never get to that point, because people like Varoufakis and Krugman associate low tax regimes with tax cuts in volatile regimes. These are two different things. So it's true that tax cuts are problematic, but they're problematic precisely because there's an expectation on the part of the people who receive the tax cut that it won't last and the incoming government will reverse it. There's another problem with tax cuts, which I saw back in the 1980s, late 80s, when I worked briefly for a tax consultancy firm. And the government was giving write-offs for capital investment. A business has normally got a balance sheet, it's got a balance sheet and it's got a profit and loss account. And assets of the business appear on the balance sheet, and then the money coming in and out appears in the profit and loss account. In the profit and loss account, you get to record depreciation. You get write-offs. You can write off a certain amount every year of your repairs and depreciation, so and all of that stuff counts as a running repair. And what the government did was they allowed big write-offs on what effectively was plant machinery. So I think you could write off the cost of computers for over 4 years. So despite the fact that these were assets of the business and it could appear on the balance sheet, you get this accelerated depreciation where you could write them off really rapidly and save a bucket load of tax. And that distorted behaviour, it meant that people were buying computers they didn't need. Because the whole point of investing in a business is that you do the things that you think will help. You know, the reason why you bought the forklift, the reason why you invested in a new warehouse, the reason why you paid for the training course for the workers was because you were the best judge of your own rational self-interest and you thought that those things would have the biggest returns on investment. That was why you did it. As soon as government has a tax regime that advantages certain kinds of business spending, then you tend to distort behaviour and throw away possible tax receipts unwisely. So the business of trying to structure a tax regime to produce the right kind of behaviour is tricky. One of the most depressing things is that, again, nobody's prepared to do what some successful economies have done, which is to follow through first principle great economist reasoning. You take the reasoning of somebody like a Ricardo and you say, what we want to do is encourage work, and we want to encourage enterprise, and we want to discourage the mere occupancy of space and rent-seeking behaviour. We don't want a society where people simply buy land and then hope to benefit from the hard work of others around them. We want a society where people engage in economic activity, whether that's starting a business or taking a job. So what you do is you tax the mere occupancy of land. You don't tax work and the running of a business and the creation of profits. But we can't do that because, again, the public won't actually listen for long enough for someone to explain it and consider that a change which they think is radical and unfair might in actual fact be good and better for all in the medium term. And again, it's the problem of democracy. You can explain to economists, and economists can explain to you why a tax regime that is all about encouraging good behaviour, even if it seems to benefit rich people, is in actual fact medium term wise. Let's actually have something approximating Singapore. Let's recognise that we don't want to give people in expanding cities windfall gains for simply owning property. Why would you want to encourage people to simply buy property and sit on their backside and wait until other people have created a prosperous area so that they can seek rent? In other words, they can actually sell their flat or house at a higher price for no economic activity at all, or they can rent out that house or flat at high rent because it's a desirable place to be commuters to industries and productive activities. This is madness, and it's what the UK has done for many years, but you can't actually persuade folk of that. So Varoufakis is right that tax regimes matter and that simply giving away possible tax is a bad idea. And he's right that the way Truss and Kwarteng have done this is at the very least suboptimal and arguably inept. But he's wrong that tax regimes that seem to benefit the more advantaged are automatically nothing more than a benefit to the advantaged. They can often be structured so as to produce tremendous benefits for the poor, and that's why this libel, this defamatory trickle-down economics label, which is just applied across the board to all centre-right economics and policy proposals, it's false. The things that are often thought to be terribly right-wing are in actual fact to the common good. We're not terribly good at working through exactly how bankers' bonuses change the world. If you're a banker, an investment banker, and you're awfully good at visiting a company and working out whether it's going to make any money or not, and whether it would be wise to make it a loan that might not be secured against assets. So you're awfully shrewd at working out exactly which pharmaceutical company is going to do well. People don't realise how the financial system actually works. Investment banks, the Barings Bank went bust because Nick Leeson, gambling in Singapore, wrecked the bank. And if you read Leeson's book, he talks about how the Baring bankers wrote an annual report saying that our tremendous gains in Singapore through the Cymex exchange seem to be insulated from any possible competitive pressure, and we can look forward to further easy, windfall returns of 25% on our capital. And Leeson, for all his faults, said, yeah, the guys who built the canals didn't think like that. You know, when Barings Bank financed the building of the canals, the Barings family put their Wellington boots on and went out and looked at the canals and tried to work out how much progress was being made each day. They stood there in the driving rain for 8 hours and watched the navvies and just checked to see how much actual progress was being made. So people don't understand how the financial system works. They don't understand that you know, investment banks and other investment vehicles employ people who've got PhDs in biochemistry and are highly numerate, precisely because for £150,000 a year, they'll go out and spend a week in a small pharmaceutical company in Slough and come back and tell you whether you should give them 10 million and it won't be secured against any assets. They're going to spend it. They're going to spend it on staff. They're going to employ biochemists and geneticists. They're going to spend it on a whole lot of things that can't be repossessed, and you hope to benefit mightily from the resulting products. Even talking about it makes me feel slightly uneasy if it was my money. But that's how the financial system works. Varoufakis, I don't think, really understands a lot of the nuts and bolts. He talks about derivatives and bonds and government gilts and how these bankers will simply invest in funds. Yes, well, funds are nothing more than pieces of paper that represent real assets with real managers standing behind them. He talks about bonds. Has he ever owned a government bond? I did. I owned Treasury 4¾ 2010 and Treasury 4¾ 2015. And I owned them when I'd worked out exactly what I thought inflation was going to be and real returns were going to be. And I sold them when I changed my mind. And when I owned that bond, I took a whole load of money that I'd earned and took it out of circulation. I gave money back to a person who originally took it out of circulation, but it amounts to the same thing. So when people produce goods and services and get paid, and they then don't go and buy a car, they don't go and buy a washing machine, they don't go and buy a holiday in the Maldives, instead they buy a government bond, that has a dramatic disinflationary effect. It means that government can then go ahead and spend money on public investment without causing inflation, because the worker who produced the goods and services is not going to go and spend money and have that chase assets or chase product. So when I bought Treasury 4¾ 2010, I allowed Gordon Brown to go and spend money on something else, a new school or a bit of a new school, a new classroom. Does Varoufakis really understand that? Does he understand? He talks about derivatives. I owned derivatives of a sort. What are derivatives? Well, there are financial products that depend for their value in some other financial product or some other event. So, for example, when I was in saving my pension, I invested in shares where the managers were selling the right to buy those shares to other people who wanted to speculate. It's called a covered call option. So what it meant was I owned the Fidelity Money Builders Fund, which was just simply British companies, major British companies. And if the price of the shares went up violently, I wouldn't benefit in the way that I would otherwise have benefited. So if the price of the shares goes down or stays the same, then the managers on my behalf pocket the money they've received from these speculators. If the price of the shares goes up violently, the speculators demand that we sell them the shares at the low price we agreed and they make money. So essentially a covered call option is a way of saying, you know what, I'll take modest returns, I'll take modest steady returns, and if you want to speculate, you can speculate. This is what these products are, and they all have their use. And the fact that they seem slightly complex and tricksy convinces people that they're occult and wicked. The fact that folk can't understand them and that some people get rich because of them makes folk believe they're in actual fact more glamorous and more difficult to understand than they really are. I did accountancy at school, and it was a retired chartered accountant, Jessie Taylor, who taught the class. And she hated me for some reason, but she liked me because I understood accounts. In a company, you can have the ordinary share, which is you can have many things, but just for the sake of this example, you can have the ordinary share, which is a share of the fundamental company. You're the last person that gets paid out when the company gets wound up. You're the last person that gets to keep everything that's left over when the company pays its bills. So that's the ordinary share. And then there can be a preference share, which is you get a fixed return, 5%, 6%, 7%. You have to get paid before the ordinary shareholders. However, it's possible that you don't get paid and they don't get paid either. Now, as soon as someone tells you that's how the preference share works, if you're kind of cunning or thoughtful, you ask yourself, okay, if I, the preference shareholder, don't get paid, and the ordinary shareholder can't get paid until I've been paid, does that carry forward to next year? Because my concern as the preference shareholder is that you don't pay me and you don't take a dividend yourself, and then next year you pay me and you take a bigger dividend. So is it a cumulating preference share or is it a non-cumulating preference share? If you don't pay me, do you have to pay me both years next year? Does it accumulate or not? Now, a lot of folk would never think that. They would never actually sit down and think, how does this actually work and what am I buying here? And because of that, and because it seems terribly sophisticated, Warren Buffett, the great investor, said that there's nothing complicated in finance that can't be understood by somebody, I think he said, with 135 points of IQ. And that was all finance. If you take away the really complex stuff, there's very little that can't be understood by somebody of ordinary intelligence. It's just not that complicated. But it is boring. And folk can't be bothered with it. And that's fine if you don't want to have any part in it. But it's not fine if you want to be the Greek finance minister and write articles in The Guardian telling other people that everything is terribly occult and difficult and complex and sinister, and therefore you're being ripped off. Because in actual fact, most finance is pretty mundane. The reason why Greece went bust was because the Greeks decided to join the euro at a nice high rate and pay all their public sector workers wages that they really didn't deserve. Their productivity was nothing like enough to justify it. Greek private sector productivity was low. It was like Romania and Bulgaria. And they ran up an absolute ton of debt that they had no possibility of servicing. And then they went bust. It had nothing to do with international finance, except insofar as one of the investment banks misrepresented Greek finance, public sector finance, misrepresented it to the EU so that Greece could join the euro. That was the only involvement. It wasn't that the private investment banks or other institutions did something wrong. It was that the Greek government did something wrong by employing one of them to fudge the figures. Similarly, the story of the 2008 bankers crash has got very little to do with anything complex and sinister and the tool of the rich to exploit the poor. It's got everything to do with we, the British people and the American people and others elsewhere, believing that we could get rich for nothing. This wasn't about the rich ripping off the poor. This was about the poor trying to rip off people unknown to them or future generations. I remember there was a programme called A Place in the Sun with Amanda Lamb. And if you'd watched it, you'd have seen on the very last series, there was a warning before the start of the programme, saying that all of these claims about how prices might go up in the future, and if you buy this house or this flat in Portugal for 120,000 euros, it could be worth 460,000 in 20 years' time. This was not financial advice, and these were simply extrapolations based on the graphs of recent price growth, and you shouldn't be relied upon. The reason why that warning was there was because I made a complaint. Because it was absolutely insane and disgusting and crazy, the things that were being said. In the UK, an investment bank paid for an Oxford economist to write a couple of briefing papers for them to examine the British housing market and to work out whether it was a bubble. And this was in 2003-04, I think. And 6 months after they were handed over to the investment bank, they were made public, because by that point they'd have used them. And they also stood to benefit if others followed their lead, I suppose. But this Oxford economist, in two very easy to read, well-written papers, explained why it was a bubble. He went through every possible explanation as to why the price rises might be real and debunked them all. This was plainly a bubble and it would explode. And of course it did. And I made some money of thinking that as well. So this wasn't anything to do with the rich and the financial system and sinister people in places like, you know, Mayfair and hedge funds. This was about ordinary folk trying to get something for nothing. This was about people, in essence, looking for... there's a famous saying which is, you can't con an honest man. In order for a con to work, there has to be an element of dishonesty in the person conned, because they have to be looking for something for nothing. Same thing with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is just a massive swizz, but it works as a swizz because Loads of people who are looking for something for nothing are bidding up the price in the hope that they'll not be the last fool, that they'll be able to get out of it by giving the package, the bag of order, give it to somebody else before they exit. And of course, one of them will be the fool and they'll lose everything, and the rest of them will have got modest gains. So it's a kind of inverse lottery. So 2008 had very little to do with the rich. It had everything to do with ordinary folk and the poor. One thing I should say is that it was the case that Northern Rock, for example, was selling its rotten, as it turned out, mortgages to a special purpose investment vehicle in Guernsey, and thereby getting them off the balance sheet and making it look as if the bank no longer was exposed to the risk. That was ludicrous. But that didn't happen because of, you know, fantastically rich, clever people in Mayfair playing with the world's wealth in their hedge fund. That happened because the managers of the organisation did it. And the regulators, which Gordon Brown had appointed, disempowered, underfunded, licensed, pick your own word. But the regulators didn't discover this when it was readily discoverable. In the same way, actually, as the lunacy of Enron was readily discoverable and was discovered. There was an article in the Financial Times months before the final bust, when somebody had taken the trouble to simply go through and read the accounts, and could demonstrate quite convincingly that it was all havers. It was, as a Scot would say, it was all nonsense. So this narrative that the gnomes of Zurich are responsible for our ills, no, it's us. It's usually us. Governments are far more responsive than you'd think. Politicians will sell you anything that they think you'll buy. I should say, however, that there is a problem when it comes to the Tory party, and I've seen it up close because I was a former Tory candidate. You can Google me later on and see exactly what I did. I told the truth when nobody wanted to hear it. But I've therefore seen a bit of the Tory party up close. I've been through and been at the hustings and watched Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt in operation. And there is a problem in the Tory party because it contains too many of exactly the kind of rent-seeking golf club bores that would pick a truss on the promise of tax cuts. So there is an issue specific to the Tory party that they're likely to chance upon somebody who will do what suits them. Because they, is it true that it's because they don't understand or because they don't care about the consequences? Probably both. But certainly the Tory party has got an issue. I think it's a fundamentally dysfunctional organisation, and my suspicion is that with the next election and the probable introduction of PR for the election after that, the Tory party is dead because it's a bad representative of centre-right economics. The reason why they oppose a land value tax and call it a garden tax is because they don't believe in centre-right economics. They don't believe in medium-term policy. They do believe in advantaging themselves to the disadvantage of the general public. So I think there is a specific problem with the Tory party, but there isn't a specific problem with centre-right policy and economics. It is right. The right is right. The classical view of how the world works, as articulated by people like Hume and Mill, it's broadly right. It's just that the present representatives in the UK are a shower, insulated by the electoral system from the consequences of their own incompetence. Thinking about it, I'm essentially a fool in motley. The king, of course, used to have a jester who would jump about dressed in his foolish suit, multicoloured motley, to make himself look ridiculous, with famously a pig's bladder inflated on a stick. And this idiot, this utter fool, was allowed to actually say things which were true, but could be taken at face value to be false, so that everyone could laugh uproariously and the king could privately digest the truth of what was said. So that's me. I'm a fool in motley. We just don't like being told the truth. We don't like being told that we all cheered wildly where Rishi Sunak gave us a fortune of borrowed money to sit in our bahookies, as a Scot would say, sit in our backsides for the thick end of 2 years. We paid females in their 20s who had absolutely, as close to zero as makes no difference, risk from COVID to stay at home and forced 50 and 60 year old overweight bus drivers to go to work. We didn't make any special attempt to protect the care homes. We could have spent £1 million in every single care home for 20 billion. That's 20,000 care homes. Instead, we spent 400 billion staying at home and buying Swift bikes and similar things and watching a lot of Netflix. And then, of course, faced with high gas prices, rather than actually have a difficult winter, we decided to keep the heating on and borrow 200 billion or 150, 160 billion, which would just about have been okay, but for the fact that we then decided to add another 45 billion onto that, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back. We don't like being told this. We talk about the energy companies making all this money and why we want a windfall tax, a tax on the windfall profits. But of course, energy companies don't really care about tax rates in and of themselves. And we won't think this through. If a country like the UK owns a whole lot of gas and oil under the North Sea, then that gas and oil is like a gold bar on the far side of the moon, or a gold bar at the top of Ben Nevis. It's a lot easier to recover a gold bar from the top of Ben Nevis than it is from the dark side of the moon. So a gold bar on the dark side of the moon has got no value whatsoever. You'd have to pay somebody $100 billion to recover it. But one on the top of Ben Nevis, you could charge somebody probably 16 grand to have access to it, because they would only need 300 quid to go up and get it, or less. So the asset as it lies under the ocean has got a certain value. And it really doesn't matter how you structure the regime. You could pay a company to lift it and give you the entire receipts from selling it, and they'd be perfectly happy with that. Or you can charge them for access to it and then let them take the risk of the sales price when they lift it. It doesn't really change anything. Oil companies make massive losses many years. Overall, they are no more productive, no more remunerative, no more advantageous to the investor than supermarkets or anything else. But we just can't be bothered. You know what I mean? We really just it's all too difficult, and we just find it all sort of slightly tedious. The Thai word for boring is, I'm trying to learn some language. The Thai word for boring is nabua. I always think that's very onomatopoeic. It just sounds boring, you know. It's interesting, actually, two wildly different languages should arrive at a word that has got a kind of similar sound, you know, like a child just exploding, boring, nabua. So we just find it all tedious. We can't be bothered thinking through. Yanis Varoufakis tells us that British productivity isn't great. And if I tell you two things that are true, do you think most of the people you would speak to in the next 6 months would know either or both of them? For example, the big difference between Britain and France in terms of productivity, half of it was mythical. It was because the fringe didn't include days when a worker was off work, whereas Britain did. So it turns out that half the difference in productivity between Britain and France was in actual fact false. France was only mildly more productive than Britain, the French worker. If I told you that our system of in-work welfare, where you can earn six or seven times your wages in in-work welfare, means that there's an infinite supply of low-skilled workers for low-productivity enterprises, and therefore if you've got a polytunnel in East Anglia or Lincolnshire that you want to grow tomatoes in or something similar, or if you've got a cafe that you want to start with only £2,000 or £3,000 of investment, if you want to do that kind of thing, that low-productivity enterprise, our in-work welfare system provides you with an infinity of willing workers and low wages. Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss were hugely criticised for suggesting they're going to apply a screw to tax credit recipients. It's already in the legislation. It's already in the legislation that tax credit recipients are supposed to be looking for more hours and more productive work, higher paid work, but it's never been enforced. So from 2004 onwards, this country created an environment where anybody who had a bad business idea could find willing workers and low wages. And that has contributed massively to our productivity crisis. But nobody thinks it through. Nobody cares. We're in a lot of trouble. I shouldn't do it, but I'm going to. The famous remark by De Maistre, every nation gets the government it deserves. That's it, you know. We deserve Liz Truss. We deserve Kwasi Kwarteng. We deserved Boris Johnson. We deserved Gordon Brown. We deserve all of it. Because we're not prepared to take time to look at what these characters are about and work out what incentives they face and change the incentives they face to stop their behaviour. Ultimately, it's all down to us. Now, I think it's true that our political system was always vulnerable to real shysters. We were always in a difficult position. In America, they've got primary elections. So if you're a real piece of work, you can be challenged in the primaries. And therefore, even if the Republican Party or the Democrats support you, if ordinary people are disgusted by you, you'll get challenged in the primaries and somebody else will take your seat. So there's a kind of jeopardy in America that doesn't exist in the UK. The parties control candidate selection. So as long as you're strongly supportive of Boris Johnson or Liz Truss, you won't lose the Tory whip. And you'll thereby keep your seat as long as the Tory vote remains shored up. So this our political system was always very vulnerable to shysters, because if there was a lack of virtue in the political class, it could very quickly become a problem in the way that it wouldn't so readily become a problem if we had a different electoral system, single transferable vote or primary elections. We were always reliant on decency. And the politicians, I fear, have become as indecent as we are inattentive. Peace.